we like to start on time. We know you people are busy people. Good evening and welcome to the fifth presentation in this, our 18th season of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, taking pictures, Haiwong Wan, and our facilities specialist, Daniel Peach. Katie Reeder designed our poster, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadon Melke. The Department of Gender and Women's Studies provided additional support for tonight's program. Our speaker tonight is a native of Trinidad and Tobago, where her family live but are now scattered around the world. Growing up, she wanted to be a physician, but the sight of blood soon changed her mind. She was influenced by those around her who were less privileged than her family and decided to pursue an education more attuned to the socioeconomic development of low-resource communities. She attended the University of the West Indies, Trinidad campus, where she earned a Bachelor of Science in Agricultural Science and a Master of Philosophy in Agriculture Extension. A Fulbright scholarship brought her to the University of Kentucky, where she received a PhD in Sociology in 1996. She joined the faculty at the University of Louisville in 2000, serving as chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies, and helped craft one of the 15 Black Studies doctoral programs in the nation. She's chaired 23 master's theses and currently chairs or co-chairs 4 dissertation committees. She's the Associate Dean for International Diversity and Community Engagement Programs, while continuing to teach classes on the theory of the African diaspora, global poverty, the feminization of poverty, and the Black family. She offers frequent study abroad programs in Trinidad. Her research focus is on social inequality and its intersection with race, ethnicity, gender, and social class, and examines the causes and outcomes of poverty. She's written extensively about poverty and sustainable development in the Caribbean, but also about African Americans in the juvenile justice system and healthy eating habits in the United States. Her first book, which is the focus of tonight's talk, Poverty as a Person, Human Agency, Women, and Caribbean Households, published by Ian Randall in 2016, was premiered at a meeting of the African, Pacific, and Caribbean States in Brussels, Belgium. Her newest book, Living Racism Through the Barrel of a Book, which she edited with Derek Brooms, has just been published by Roman and Littlefield. When not teaching or researching, she enjoys mentoring her students and gardening. Please welcome Teresa Rajak-Talley. Teresa.
Okay. Good evening. First of all, I'd like to thank all the organizers for this event. It's truly an honor and a privilege to be here. When I agreed, when Brian contacted me, I had no idea what I was agreeing to. And then think about it until now. And then even coming down here, I wasn't sure what I was going to meet. But my dinner with some lovely people has made me feel very welcome and at home. So I'm comfortable talking to you tonight. Please feel free to ask me whatever you want to ask me. And I will decide whether I'm going to answer or not. As Brian said, the title of the book is Poverty as a Person, Human Agency, Women, and Caribbean Households. Initially, I had thought about labeling the book Poverty as a Person, Not a Statistic, Human Agency, Caribbean Households. And my publisher said she preferred this name, made it a little shorter, but the content is still about that. As Brian said, I launched it in Brussels at an African, Caribbean, and Pacific group of countries. It was an amazing experience, and I can tell you about that afterwards. I thought I was going into a small meeting of non-governmental organizations because they told me it was a workshop about women and youth. When I got in there, I got all the frills, fancy treatment and so forth. And then when I walked into the room with the Secretary General, who's at the corner there, it was a room full of ambassadors from the African, Caribbean, and Pacific group of countries. And all I could say is, thank goodness I packed a suit. But it went well. This is, for those of you all who do not know the Caribbean, first point of clarification. The Europeans call us the West Indies because of the history. North American and now tourism call us the Caribbean. We are one and the same. So you will see that interchangeably when we talk about the University of the West Indies. My humble beginnings, as Brian explained, I went to the University of the West Indies, got 2 degrees there, and then taught there for a while before coming to the U.S. on my Fulbright scholarship. Had no intention of staying, but I fell in love, the usual stuff, and everything falls in place there. The map shows the Caribbean countries, both the English-speaking, Spanish-speaking, Dutch-speaking, and French-speaking. I worked in most of those Caribbean countries, and the book, the content of the book, is based on studies that were done for most of them. This is what people know about the Caribbean. I've come to term it Sandals Caribbean, because everywhere you go, the publications they add is about sandals and the Caribbean. And I took different pictures of different countries, and you will see Montego Bay to Barbados to other islands, and they keep opening new ones. So most of you and most of the world will know of the Caribbean, Sandals' version of the Caribbean. And it is real, it's not a Photoshop. But I want to argue that there's an other side to Sandals' paradise. And this is what the book is about. I put those various pictures there so you can see, you know, a conglomeration of the other side of paradise, the ones that you do not see, the ones that they tell you do not leave the compound. That's why they're all inclusive, do not take a drive, it's not safe, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, this is not just unique to the Caribbean, because from my research, poverty is well hidden. Even in the United States, you have highways, byways, major roads that bypass the low-income neighborhoods. So all over the world, the issue of where people who live in low-resource communities are usually invisible and their voices muffled. And so this is the other side of Sandals' paradise. But the Caribbean is more than sandals and the other side. I wanted to describe it, so I said, you know what? The best way I can describe it is that the Caribbean is just a smaller part of the world. It is no different. It has the rich, it has the poor, it has the middle-income people. It has high levels of development, it has poverty, extremely rich. And so I wanted to reflect that in this slide here so that we do not get confused that the Caribbean is either sandals or the other side, but it's a mixture of all kinds of things. From here, you can see we have very well-developed cities. We have energy and infrastructure. We have progressive things like geothermal stuff, micro business, and so forth. I put the data there so you can see why I say it's just a smaller part of the world. The Caribbean or the West Indies consist of a series of islands, all very small. And the populations are also very small. The type of economy for most of the Caribbean countries is tourism. We have some agriculture and some energy sectors, like in Trinidad, it's an oil and natural gas base. In Suriname and Guyana, to some extent, you have diamonds and so forth. Now, historically, most of the Caribbean islands or countries were agricultural base. And that's why, you know, you had colonization in the early days, because they came for the agricultural products there, mainly sugar, coffee, bananas, and a couple of coconuts and a couple others. Over time, what has happened, because of colonization and global capitalism, what has happened is that the agricultural sector globally is now dominated by the industrialized societies. And what that did, it ruined the agriculture sector for places in the Caribbean and other parts of developing countries globally. And so what has happened, the economy has shifted from more agricultural base to more tourist base. And so it also shifted from being independent countries to dependent countries, because tourism is not it's a dependent type of economy. And people will disagree with me, but this is my talk, so I'll say that. So the Caribbean has many sides, right? And I kind of put all those pictures there together. You have sandals, you have highly developed cities, you have the poverty, and of course, our famous carnival in Trinidad and all over. We are also known for our carnival and our attractive women. Okay, so what has happened over the years? I think it's about 20 or 30 years ago, there was a social development conference, and it was decided that we need to address certain social inequalities and poverty in the region. So the Caribbean Development Bank, which I call the World Bank for the region, it operates in the same way. It access funds, monitor funds, distribute funds based on, you know, the needs of the region. So there's a Caribbean Development Bank, which is situated in Barbados, but serves the region. They agreed to do poverty studies of all the countries. And so what would happen is that different organizations and institutions would bid to do these poverty studies, and then they would be given out. And I got involved through this company called Kyrie Consultants. And that's how we started, well, myself started doing poverty studies in the Caribbean. We call them poverty studies or national assessment of living conditions. That's a funny, I'll tell you that story later on. But I decided to work with Kyrie Consultants because I like their research design. And they tend to be very participatory and inclusive. Not all the poverty studies that were done for the Caribbean Development Bank used the approach we used. So the company I worked for, and I did a community engagement scholarship talk yesterday on how do we include it in tenure and promotion for those who are budding professors in the audience. And there are three ways we can keep ourselves engaged in community research. We can do volunteer, we can do research grants, or we can do consultancy. So what I did is I did consultancy with Kyrie, and they would pay for me to travel and collect data and so on. We would do technical reports, which we would submit to the development bank and the governments of the country, and I would get access to the data. And so that's how the book evolved in terms of the data. My role in these poverty studies, they were highly complex studies, a lot of research, and I tried to tell my colleagues, sometimes these technical reports require a lot more work, research, than your referee publication, right? So we worked as a team, we used multi-methods in the research. We did quantitative surveys, household surveys, by the thousands. We did institutional analysis. We did focus group interviews. We did individual interviews. We did case studies of households. So it was a very large research project. My role whenever I participated was doing the participatory approach to poverty assessment. And people think that the participatory approach basically requires you going into the community and talking to a couple of folks or doing a couple of interviews. It's much more complex and scientific than that. And as you can see from this chart, and I will not go through each one of them, but there's a research component, there's a capacity building and transfer skill component, there's training, and there's monitoring and evaluation. I like this approach because it's about empowering people to do their own research and assessment from the higher levels to the community levels. This is another reason why I like this approach. You need to go yourself into the fields, homes, and communities. A common experience of people who are low resource or living in poor living conditions globally, not just in the Caribbean. That was the beauty about the book. Although it used Caribbean case studies, I wrote it in a way that chapters can be used nationally and internationally. Anybody who's concerned about working with low-resource communities. The commonality of this is that people who live in these communities, I talked about their lack of visibility earlier. there's also a lack of voice. And they will tell you this, no one hears us. No one is interested in asking us, you know? So when you do the participatory approach and you go into the communities, into the households, into the homes, into the fields, and you ask people what they think, how they view, how they assess, you record it, document it, and play it back, then what you're doing is you're giving voice to those who are powerless in the political and economic sphere. So those are pictures of me in the fields. Dragged my husband, who's a sociologist, in the field. There's another colleague here in the field. The other thing, too, is I teach research methods to my doctoral students, and I teach about good research methods. Part of good research methods, if you're researching a community that you do not belong to, I mean culturally or racially or ethically and so on, it's important to have in your research team people who look like the people you're researching or people who are from that community. It's not just good research, but it is the right thing to do, because what it does, it allows the people who you are researching to feel a certain level of comfort. And they tell you things that they will not tell other people. Plus, you develop a relationship with that community. And my latest thing is on epistemology and methodology, but that's another talk. But these are some of the reasons why you go into the field, and this is how the qualitative part of the research method works. So it generates micro-level data, it complements the quantitative research, but it highlights the type and the multidimensional nature and the distribution of poverty, which quantitative research does not do. And of course, last but not least, by including the community, it also empowers them to affect policy. Yeah, participatory poverty research, or participatory research, has been around for a long time. It emerged, as far as I could trace it, back to developing countries like Africa and Asia in rural communities with women. What has happened over the years, it has evolved as a scientific method of research, so much so that the World Bank now includes it in their research process. Universities apparently are slower than the World Bank because we do not give a lot of weight to the participatory approach. But what I show, and these are real charts, I have them in my office because I pull them out and show my students that I'm not making this up. There are sophisticated tools that can be used now when you're doing these community-based research. It allows community to assess for themselves their situation. So it's not just going to communities and getting the information and you doing the analysis. This process allows the community to provide the information, do their own assessment and evaluation, and for you to report what they are assessing and evaluating their situations to be, and not just you, the researcher. So these are some of the sophisticated tools that we use. This one, I think, is the Wheel of Well-Being, and I can't see what that other one is, but so this is what we use in community-based research. What we found, and what I talk about in the book, is first and foremost, you never ever go into a community and tell them that they are poor. Don't describe them as that. Don't define them as that. Don't perceive them as that. Because that has a lot of weight, a lot of connotations, a lot of judgment. Let them define for themselves how they see their situations and their households and so forth. Right, calling someone can be very poor, can be very offensive. The other thing that I found, that how people perceive their living conditions or what poverty is, oftentimes is very relative. The same images that you see on your TV of the potbelly African or the potbelly Asian child when they're asking you to give donations and so on, are the same images that we see on the television screen in the Caribbean. So when we go to these communities and ask them, you know, what do you think about poverty? Who are poor? They have these same images. So they describe their living conditions relative to what they see on the screen. That's one aspect of it. The other thing that I found is how people define themselves and their living conditions also vary by the demographics of the population. So you'll see here women defining things as relative to feeding the family, educating the family, meeting family needs. Men often defined it relative to employment and income, but also relative to income and employment to support the family. The unemployed, I put a couple quotes here. This is one of the, you know, horrible definition that somebody gave, that unemployed meaning having to borrow a room to live in. Youth, I mean, the youth, they were the hardest when they defined their living conditions. We got some real tough ones that required a lot of composition for myself, not to break down. One youth said, having to throw your dreams away. One youth said, poverty is not having a father and a mother to take care of you. And he wasn't talking about being an orphan. He was talking about having parents who had to work so hard that they did not have time for themselves. One of the most touching one that came from a youth, I was waiting at a home, because as I say, you have to go out and do the interviews in the community. So I was waiting in this home to interview this woman, and her daughter came in. And so, typical teacher style me, the first thing I ask is, are you going to school? What school are you going to? What subjects are you doing? Do you like school? And I started that conversation with this child. And then something in me, I have no idea where it came from, but I asked her, I said, how do they treat you in school? And she turned to me, she looked me in the face, and she said, Miss, they tease me because I smell. My mother does not have adequate money to buy deodorant. I mean, I could have just fallen off my chair, I could have broken down and cried, but I remember what I tell my students, when you're doing interviews, you have to be composed. Not unfeeling at all, because they will recognize if you do not care. So you develop this skill, well, not a skill. It's real, because if you put it on, they will know. If you care, it will show. But you have to keep yourself composed. So I gave myself a few minutes without saying anything, and then I continued chatting with her. Elderly. The elderly say they feel as if they've forgotten. One great quote, which I almost titled the book with, is came from an elderly person where she said, poverty is a crime, not a sin. And of course, you do have intergenerational poverty, where people describe historically how their families were always poor. I put this one here because people always ask me, well, how do you feel when you do these studies? And I mean, I'm not even giving you the horror ones, I'm giving you the middle range horror ones. And so I said, every time I go into a community, every time I speak with people who are living in dire circumstances, there's always a light there. There's always somebody there who is so hopeful, who's doing so much more than I can ever do, that it makes you feel good to a certain extent. It gives you encouragement and strength to continue. And this is seen here, where in most of the communities we did our community assessments of, where they described their well-being using some of those tools I showed you earlier, is that physical and materials always average to low. Average because they were looking at it relative to somewhere else. Low is more the reality of the situation. Same thing with social and cultural, social meaning, social services. Economics, always low across the board, right? But spiritual and psychological was always high. And that is when you live in these communities, when we try to describe our social and economic situation, we go by employment, income, you know, the house we live, our zip codes, and so on. Low-resource communities talk about their assets. Their assets are always their family, their religion, and their community. And that is always high, and that is what keeps them going, and that's what keeps me going when I do these studies. this one was when I wrote the book, and I gave it to people to read and so on. My reviewers, in fact, were very harsh, and one of my reviewers thought that I should just do on women, right? But other than that, when other people read it in the early days, this was the chapter that stood out for most of them. And you'll see it in the thing. And this is also the chapter my mother liked the best. She said she can relate to it to a large extent. But the social and psychological aspect, and this was particularly for the woman. Look at those brilliant, beautiful, strong women in there. You know, when you see them, when you talk to them and so on, no matter how terrible their living conditions are, they give you strength instead of you give them strength. So I was talking to these women and so forth, and they were telling me these horrible stories and how they have overcome it. And it dawned on me, this is the same image that we have of African-American women. You have the strong black matriarch, right? And they were strong black matriarchs, because when they told me their stories and how they overcame it and how they're still continuing to survive and support their family, I was like, wow, these are really, really strong, amazing women. But then I was reflecting on what they were telling me, and I was like, this is terrible. This is horrible. This is sad. So on one of the interviews, I asked one of the women, I said, tell me something. Do you ever cry? And at that moment, she broke down and cried. And then she started telling me the social psychological experiences of her. And you could see some of them there. The first part talk about the strength, you know. Things are not bad, not hopeless, but powerless. We are invisible, no one cares. We do not want handouts, but help. There's nobody I trust, no one to go to. I keep it bottled up inside. Things bad, I want to do bad things to myself. I lock myself up in my room and cry. I turn to God and prayers. And I thought, wow. So what I did is every interview subsequently, somewhere in the middle or to the end of the interviews, I asked the same question. And invariably, they would break down and cry and tell me the sad part of their experiences. So this is now emerging into a theory about the social and psychological dimensions, not only of poverty, but of strong black women. I have one of my current MA students, she's doing her research on black grandmothers and looking at the social and psychological aspect of it, because it humanizes them. It humanizes them. Because you could be strong, you could be overcoming all these dire conditions and still supporting your family and also have human emotions. It does not have to be one or the other, because that is what it is to be human. When we look at it from one side, on the opposing side, what we're doing, we are dehumanizing the female head of household. So, and particularly, this was a very awakening discovery on my part. And one of the interesting things where she says, I lock myself up in my room and cry, is because she's trying to protect her children from knowing what she's experiencing. And so she's thinking she's hiding it from them and in her privacy. But you know what? When I ask the kids, they know. They tell me, I hear my mom crying. They tell me that when they misbehave, right, it's not because of their parents' fault. They tell me when they hear their parents arguing or even shout at them, it's not because of them, but because of the hardship that they know that their parents are going through. So the social psychological dimensions run very deep. Another, I told you, this piece of research, it took me years to get the research, but it's the analysis where all these theoretical perspectives, new theoretical perspectives are emerging, and they're very challenging. And one of the challenges, and they're debunking a lot of the stereotypes. I love that woman, influenced me to a large extent. She is one of the women in the communities who's a female leader. Right? She lives with them, she has similar experiences, but she's a leader among them. And the other thing that struck me is the beauty of these women. the beauty not just physically, but psychologically and emotionally. Very, very, very deep beauty. And she told me this, every woman must want to look good. Just put yourself together, even if your clothes is cheap. And that struck me again with the stereotype, because I've heard people who are working in organizations and offices that are working with low-income folks comment about how they spend their money. I've heard people tell me to my face that, oh, when she gets her food stamp or whatever, the first thing she does is go and do her hair. I've heard people say, well, look at her nails. I can't afford to do my nails like that. They comment about how they use their food stamp to buy what in the supermarket. Why are they buying that? Why they can't buy a healthy thing? So my answer to them is because they're human beings. They're human beings and they make the same choices we make. I'm sure there's nobody in this room who have not done the same thing, has spent money on something that they should not have, that they today I'm not feeling so good, so I'm going to binge eat. I'm not feeling good, I'm going to get my hair done. You know, I'm not feeling good, I'm going to the bar and have a drink. I don't know what the guys do, but whatever you do, right? Because you're human beings. And so we expect people, because they do not have the resources we have, to be different. And we criticize them, and we are judgmental on them. And what this woman said was quite true. When you have nothing, nothing, when the world is crushing you, and you have hungry mouths to feed, and you have to get up there and go out and work and be humiliated by society, humiliated by your mate, physically and socially abused by the society, when you are thrown away, sometimes the only thing that keeps you going is how you look. And this woman is telling all of us women that she's dealing with, you have to make yourself look good, however you can. And it's not like they have a whole bunch of money to go and spend. They don't have it, so how could you claim that this is what they're doing? You know, you are not feeding their family. That woman is feeding her family. She will never put herself above her children. So if she goes and gets her nails done, or she goes and buys a piece of clothes, it's not because her children are doing it out. And of course, this is another one. Mother has the load of the family. If woman is of poor condition, then the children is poor. I put that one there because oftentimes when we talk about community development, poverty alleviation, any kind of development you want to talk about, family development, whatever you want to talk about, we are never focused on the mother of those families because the stereotype is she's not the breadwinner. You know, she is supplemental. And that's what this woman is saying, is that you need to focus on the mother of that family. Because if she is not well, or has well-being, however you want to define it, then the entire family is affected. Yeah, my pet peeve, feminization of poverty. Debunking Western methodological and ideological concepts. The feminization of poverty is a concept that emerged in North America with Diane Pierce. 1978, she coined the term, but she was looking at poverty trends in the 50s and 60s in the US. And what she found is that more women were heading single female-headed households, partly because of higher divorce rates and also because of whatever reasons at that point in time. The point in question here is that when Diana Pierce raised this term, she was also advocating that the government was not giving adequate support to female single-headed households. I say there's some methodological and ideological challenges to this concept because when Diana Pierce was referring to the US, she was talking primarily about the white women in the U.S., particularly white middle-class women who were now either choosing to be single or getting divorced, or there's a whole family studies on why they were becoming more single, white female-headed households, and why government was not supporting them. What happened? The term is a beautiful term, feminization of poverty. It makes sense because a lot of women and a lot of female-headed households are living near or below the poverty line. If you look at the gender of the poor, not poverty within single female-headed households, there's a difference there. But because the term is so catchy and so reflective, it stretched all over the world, right? And so everybody started using the feminization of poverty concept. And so I challenged it, looking at the situation in the Caribbean, and then a colleague of mine and I challenged it, looking at black women in the US, and say that there are problems with the methods of assessing this concept of feminization of poverty and also the ideological concept. Because what it is suggesting is that the reason why single female-headed households are experiencing increasing levels of poverty, it's because it's a structural situation, a family structure. So that the reverse side of that is poverty alleviation requires two-parent household, particularly with a male breadwinner. The flip side is that because women are living in single female-headed household, this is a moral decision. Right? So we challenge that because both of those are not true. And I put what we discovered there. Households do not necessarily experience poverty because they're headed by women or because of an absent male breadwinner. While female-headed households are more likely to experience poverty, it's not always the case, and I have data to show that. Single female-headed households, and this is the key, single female-headed households are poor or living below the poverty line because the women who head these households experience simultaneously discrimination of gender, class, race, and ethnicity, immigration, status, and other social characteristics. Women and gender study folks in the audience, sociologists in the audience, will understand what I'm talking about. It's not the family structure. It's the discrimination against women and the intersectionality of all these things that are giving them a wage that they're unable to support themselves and their family. Think about it. If they were getting a wage where they could support themselves and their family, there would be no problem with single female-headed households as it relates to poverty. And also specific to the Caribbean, we have high percentages of single female-headed households. Historically, we've had that. You know, it ranges from 20 to 40% in different countries. These single female-headed households have produced presidents, teachers, doctors, lawyers, staff members working every possible way, entrepreneurs. They have produced very successful children, even if they had poor living conditions, which was not always the case, right? So that debunks the myth that is the family structure or the moral decision to live like this that is causing poverty. The other thing that I always argue, and I find this one particularly disturbing too, is that the way the feminization of poverty argues is that, you know, because women are moving into these situations, are in these situations, that they are causing poverty. And I point out why that's not the case. But also too, I flip that as well. When I think about these women and how hard they're working to support their family, I'm like, so if they weren't working, what was going to happen to these families? If these women were not in those households, what was going to happen to these families? They would have been living in abject poverty, indigenous rape, where they couldn't feed themselves, they were hungry. So I thought about it. I said, these women are actually preventing abject poverty in these families. They are unable to move families from a low resource to a higher resource household, but at the same time, they are preventing that household from going homeless on the street, without food, malnourished. So they are actually doing something very positive. And that's important, because if you're going to develop strategies to alleviate poverty, or community development, or household development, however you want to spin it, it does not always have to be about poverty, then you need to know what these women are doing and direct your programs and projects to those situations. Because they are adopting strategies that are working. But if they get the resources, they can make those strategies not just keep families from going into abject poverty, but move them up from a low resource to a middle resource household. That's the green one. The last one there, we tend to demonize single female-headed households or women who head these households. And we do that all over the world. Well, in the Caribbean, not so much. It's more a situation here where we demonize single female-headed households, particularly black female-headed households. We always talk about the welfare queens. We have this image that particularly in urban centers, you have all these young black girls having babies so they could live off social welfare. I asked my class on global poverty, have you ever tried to apply for social welfare? It's the most complicated, dehumanizing process. And I have my cousin-in-law here who is a social worker. Who would want to do that, willingly want to do that? Then when you do get it, you lose your privacy. The social work system monitors everything, including your social wife. Do you have a male living here? What is the relationship? What is he contributing? Are you working on the side in a store so you can make a little money to buy a Christmas present for your kids? And if they find that's true, they take away social welfare. Right? So they demonize these women who are trying to support their family and have nothing else, nowhere else to go, but dehumanize themselves, go through the offensive and complicated process so they can feed their families. And then the flip side of that, you have the image of the strong black matriarch. And what that does is like, she's a strong woman. She does not need our help. She can manage that. She could handle that. And there's research coming out now to show that in domestic violence cases where women kill their husbands because of domestic violence between white and black, that the black woman would get harsher sentences because of the image of her versus the image of the white female who's supposed to be the helpless victim. You know, so that those two images work negative for these women. I won't go through all of that, but basically, I wanted in the book to debunk the myth of the male breadwinner, because it's interesting. It's interesting when you live in a global society. Women in the Caribbean historically has been the breadwinner. Through slavery and indentureship, they were not brought to the region as wives and mothers and housekeepers. They were bought as workers, be them slave workers or indentured servants workers. Okay? So we have that history and that ideology, but colonization and westernization has introduced patriarchy into our society. So the image is of the male breadwinner, when in reality it may not be like that. Right? So I had to write an entire chapter highlighting women as the female breadwinner in all the different sectors. And for low-resource households, these were agriculture, tourism, entrepreneurship, immigrants. So when you see those immigrant women coming over here and doing domestic work and housekeeping and trying to make it, it's because they are supporting a family back home. It's not because they want to buy the fancy dresses and the boots and the fur coats and jewelry. It's because they are supporting families back home. And so women have always and continue to be breadwinners in all these different sectors, including in tourism. For those of you all who go around the world on tourist trips and so on, see how many women are working in the tourist sector. I like the second to last one there. Both women's families and countries cannot not afford women to be breadwinners. Cannot not afford women to be breadwinners. If women stop being breadwinners, not only would the families suffer, but communities and society, because they are generating a lot of income for your country. And we have formal sector and informal sector, and that's a whole lot of another lecture. But they do this through these two sectors. They work in both and they move between those. Now, in the Caribbean specific, great strides have been made in terms of education for women, right? And in fact, I always amaze at Trinidad where I'm from. Education is like an industry there. Everywhere you go, there's a school. There's a school if you drop out, there's a school linked to US school, you get a lot of certificates and so on. So we are highly educated, so much so that it sometimes causes gender disaccord because women are moving up and men are not, just like here. And so we have come a long way. We are highly employable, we are highly educated, we hold important positions and so on. But at the same time, there is still a group of women who are not included, who are low educated, have low skills, and are working for low wages. And that's the population that I focus on in this book. There was another slide. Where did it go? Oh, no, it's the same slide. Yeah. I wanted to show the images there. That's the pointer here. Female president. We have a female president, or did have she. I think she's now gone. But we always had female presidents or prime ministers in the Caribbean. When Grenada was, invaded by the U.S., there was a female prime minister in Dominica. You know, so we've had female prime ministers. We've had female senators. We have female judges. We have female senators. We have female highly skilled. We have women in the tourist sector, women entrepreneurs in the service sector, women who are agriculture. So we are everywhere in every single sector. Coming to the end, what I wanted to point out is poverty is a global phenomenon. It's not just those potbelly kids living in Africa or Asia, and it's not the Caribbean photos that I showed you earlier. But it's all over. It's both in the north and in the south. It's invisible and it's voiceless, and we are maneuvered away from it so that we do not recognize it in our own backyard. When I teach my course on global poverty, I ask every single student to volunteer in an organization in the city of Louisville, where the clientele come from low-resource households. I said, I want you to recognize that it's in your backyard and my backyard. It's not something happening over there. And so it's a global problem. It would not go away. The statistics are horrendous. And I like the statistics, and I'll give you this little story. There was a colleague of mine who annoyed me. He said something silly, and I was like, he observed something silly. And when I found out, I said, you know what? Next time I see him, I'm going to tell him, do you know 900 million people go to bed hungry every night? The 25,000 kids die every day from malnutrition? That is what you should be occupying your mind with, and not that silly issue that you wanted to make that observation about. And think about it. It's such a global problem. How many universities offer courses on poverty? So it's invisible and voiceless there again. And believe me, I'm a conspiracy theorist. This is not by accident. What is important to note too, that the gap between the North and South is widening. And the gap between the rich and poor is also widening. And women and women-headed households are disproportionately affected. The chart here is some data that we had put together for the US. If you cannot read it, this is for all. This is for white US households. And these two lines are African American and Latino. So what it basically shows that the intersectionality of race, and this is female-headed households, the intersectionality of race, social class, and gender, it is what puts these two groups higher than the average. What must we do? And this is my last slide, basically. And I came up with this because when my second reviewer looked at my book, and he was the kinder one, he said to me, he said, well, in his review, his comments was that everything in the book is accurate and so forth, but the recommendations that are being put forward is nothing new. We know this. I mean, not everybody, but those who are concerned know this. He said, why don't you put something that you discovered in there that is different? So he sent me back to the drawing board, and I said, well, I know I did this, but if he's not getting it, that means I have to write it in a way where it stands out. So I rewrote the conclusion chapters. And what everybody knows and agrees to is that we do have methodological and theoretical challenges, right? Particularly when we adopt North American concepts and methods. We do not have to adopt them wholesale. We could always modify and adapt them to our situation, and we should, because no one size fits all. And in fact, when you do that, you give wrong analysis. That mixed methods is what is required. And when you do mixed methods, you have to include the participatory approach if you want to give voice, face, and power to those that you are studying, and not dominate it with your own ideas and analysis. It requires building social equality within and across communities. And that's where, if you go back to the participatory approach diagram that I had, capacity building was an important part of what we did. So when we left that country or that community, they were equipped to do the studies themselves. And the communities were equipped to do their own assessment as well. And when I talk about capacity building, and not just about doing the poverty studies, but capacity building to help communities move from one income level to the other. Must address all dimensions and all levels, because I point out how many of those folks who read my chapter on the social and psychological was, you know, loving it because they never thought about it before. The one in the red is what I contributed to poverty studies, because all those other things, not everybody knew, but some people knew. This is the one here. You have to expand your analysis to include the cognitive, which is the experiential part of it, that's social, psychological, what people experience, how they feel, how they respond, their strategy, their tactics. Relational is what everybody avoids because it involves power structures. Most progressive poverty studies, including the team I work with, avoid that relational one. I was reading the earlier chapters while I was preparing for this, and I came across this something that I had in there. Whereas in the US, in the North American standard, we tend to focus on the cultural aspects of poverty. We blame poverty on people's culture, either individual, family, or community. He's lazy, doesn't want to work. Family values. That particular group doesn't value education. You know, I mean, all that is myth. And I debunk that when I'm looking at the US. But so when I looked at issues in the Caribbean, we focus on the political economy. So all the poverty studies that were done historically and in contemporary times is separated out from the poverty studies into the political economy literature. So we talk about the impact of colonization, global capitalism, right? So what I did here is I said, we gotta link both. We gotta link the political economy with the human agency. And we have to look at North-South relations, and we have to look at relations by social class within country and within communities. We have to look at the relational aspect of power if we really seriously want to address issues of poverty. And last but not least, of course, is the gendered aspect. There's no way we can be serious about addressing poverty, poor living condition, underdevelopment, educational disparity, health disparity, without having a gender element of it and recasting women's role. We have to recast women's role. We have to debunk those stereotypes. They're not helpful. So last but not least, what those things do, well, all those things, what they do is tell you that poverty is a person and not a statistic. Last slide. Women carry the world in their heads and on their heads. And I like that photo of me next to that person there, because you know how I see this image? I see this image as like, if I did not have the opportunity, the resources and privilege, I would be her. And if she had the opportunity, the resources and privilege that I had, she would be me. Simple as it is, that's the reality of the situation. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
I'm in a development economics class, so we talk about kind of a debate in the macro level between Jeffrey Sachs and William Easterly about whether we need more of it or we need less of it. So I was wondering, in your research, especially kind of in the community level, what side do you agree on the efficacy of aid?
The thing, it's not the aid per se, it's the conditions of the aid and the way it is implemented and processed. And to me, that is the problematic one, because a lot of times this aid is very controlling and dehumanizing. It takes away the independence of the people and as a result, the humanity and dignity of folks. You know, and I'm glad you asked that question, because one, I started getting involved in all of this stuff. I had to go to economics. So one of the papers I wrote was Trade Liberalization, Poverty, and the ACP Countries. Because they tend to keep them separate, right? One is, basically, when you talk about looking at poverty or poor living conditions, low resource communities and households, or that's social services. That's how they see it, social services. And then when you talk about economic development and trade and so on, oh, that's economics. And I always ask, how could you have economic development without social development? And how could you have social development without economic development? And that's what they do not address. And it's the same issue we had with the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the structural adjustment policies. They were supposed to help you, right? But if you're in a debt, you go to a bank, and they give you money at a high interest rate. How are you ever going to get out of that debt? Everything you earn, you're paying on interest, right? And you young people will know that, because you get credit cards with higher interest rates than us who are better off than you. It just doesn't make sense. If I had to give credit cards, I would give lower interest rates to those who need it most and give the higher interest rates to those who could afford it, right? And that is what these structural adjustment policies did. They did not help, they crammed, it's like welfare. When I was telling you that when you apply for social welfare, it's a complicated process, but then you are basically signing your life off to these offices. That is what structural adjustments and the IMF did to the region and all over the world. And that's what AIDS do. The biggest culprit is World Bank, you know? But if you are involved in any kind of community development, women and gender studies, social sciences, sociology, poverty studies, you have to get into economics and political economy. And you have to look at trade relationships, particularly now. You know, we are in the midst of talking about all these. I understand what trade tariffs and barriers are when Donald Trump is talking about it, because I had to understand what I was talking about at the macro, micro level, because the macro level affects the micro level, and the micro level affects the macro level. You know, so it's the issue with AIDS. It's not about the aid itself, but it's the process and the conditions that are extremely harmful and dehumanizing, and to a large extent, very patriarchal as well.
Question? Back here?
No, you can't ask. You can't ask a question.
Oh, I really appreciate your book and presentation. I was thinking about your arguments about the nature of community studies, some of the pathologies that they sort of operate on relative to the communities that they're studying. I was thinking just about the sociological profession and how these ideas, particularly of non-white populations, you know, from the outsider looking in, that it had really deep roots, you know, in that profession. And your idea about this idea of matriarchy, matrifocal kind of structures. I was thinking about Daniel Patrick Moynihan and his book, Crisis of the Black Family, where he argued like this matrifocal structure is a problem, and that the way, and there needs to be models after which black men can sort of emulate themselves. So his solution was sending them off to war so they could learn how to be men. Right, so I was thinking about all that stuff. So it's very important that you're working through these things, because they have really deep roots. But I was also thinking about how your work is theorizing about the issue of poverty in a diaspora context. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
In terms of how can we link these communities across the diaspora, you know. Mm-hmm. And think about this
as a diaspora framework. Yeah, well, following the book, another colleague of mine, Dr. Bess, she and I chaptered a journal article on the feminization of poverty in the black family, where we did a comparison of the Caribbean and the African-American family. And we found, actually it was called methodological and ideological challenges. And we found the same methodological and ideological challenges and misconception that is being used in the Caribbean that is used for the African-American family. There's a lot of similarities between Caribbean families and African-American families, so it's easy to do that kind of comparison. But generally, what I like to think too, and that was one of the, not arguments, but one of the comments that one of the reviewers gave me, one of the harsh reviewers, about it should only be about women, it should be only on the chapter on the social and psychological dimension. And I thought about it and I said, you know what? I always argue that as individuals, as women, we cannot separate ourselves, right? So why should I try to separate myself in this book? And that's why I took some of the things she said, of course, and addressed it. But I kept the book organized in this way because it had so much variation in it that I gave an overview for the Caribbean, because a lot of people don't know, right? And then I talked about poverty measures, right? The standard measures and the ones that we used and tried and how they work. I critiqued the feminization of poverty. I did the one on female breadwinners. I talk about household dynamics, and a lot of these things can be applied with certain adaptation, right? And I also did the one about the relational aspect so that people could know that you also cannot look at communities in isolation, that we are all connected. We're all connected within country, and we're all connected across the globe, right? And we have to be careful with universalization of concepts and methods and process, because they cannot be applied, but they are biased, they are biased and will give you, and from an academic perspective, they will give you a wrong analysis. From a policy perspective, you will make wrong or ineffective policy. And from a humanist perspective, you are dehumanizing certain populations. So at all levels, that what I am recommending and suggesting, and this is not me personally, but what the research is suggesting and recommending, is important that you do multi-level, multidisciplinary, multidimensional, and address these aspects. I mean, people like Sachs and Amrita Sen and all of they talk about it too. And I talk about them in the book because they address a certain section. They talk about people's freedom and building capacity and so on. But Sen doesn't elaborate it to the global perspective, where some of our political economists in the Caribbean, like Govan, and I started with Beckford, they talk about that relationship. They talk about the political economy and how that impacts income levels and so on.
Questions? Yes.
Recalling an op-ed that I read, Eugene Wilkinson, I think it's in Chicago or even Washington, I can't remember, but he said that there are basically three groups of people who look at poverty and how they define it. They are either abolitionists, you know, they want to do away with poverty, or there are the deniers who say poverty, you know, doesn't exist, it's not there, you know. And then there are those who are very apologetic. You know, oh, I'm so sorry you're poor, I'm so sorry you're poor for that. Do you agree with that? Do you describe fall into any of those categories? How we think about poverty?
The thing is, how we think about poverty has a particular history. So there's a history in the U.S. about how we view poverty. And the history of that is, initially, we did not look at people that way. We looked at people like how some southern communities, how you all looked at us when we came in. We weren't strangers. We were people from outside the community coming in, and you lent us. It was part of your culture and your upbringing and whatever to be hospitable to people coming in. Then we had mass migration of people, and then it actually emerged when they said, when in this country, when they said, well, we now have to define people so that we could determine who to give social welfare system to. And they came up with the concept of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, and who these people were and so on. And so it kept snowballing, right? But it came down to resources, distribution of resources, you know. Distribution resources is a dangerous animal, right? Because, as I say, we do not have a situation globally of poverty. We have a problem of distribution of resources. When we think about how much wastage that we have, we dump things so that the price could stay a certain way on the global market. Look at the trade wars that are going on now, right? We have enough resources to support this world populations. We have enough resources to bring people out of dire poverty, right? But global capitalism is such that we have to have social stratification based on class and protect what we have. So that concept of welcoming the stranger is no longer here in the U.S. And it has gone so far that we are now attacking the immigrants. You know, so you have to be careful where these thought processes come from, why they're there, and what is the history behind them. Where were we as a people before these ideas came? That's the place we have to go back to.
I think starting in the 1990s, poor countries or industrialized countries were asked to give 0.52% GDP to help eliminate poverty in the world. I think by 2015, they didn't reach the goals that they had in mind, but the poverty rates are down.
Yeah, they are down. And it goes back to this whole, it's interesting, the World Bank and the concept of you know, the whole situation with the IMF and so on. First of all, they went and they distributed, well, they didn't distribute it. You had to actually negotiate and bargain for this loan and then sell your soul, your country, and everybody else to get the money, right? And so most of the countries who took the loans from the IMF and had to adopt structural adjustment policies fell. So now when they're way down there, World Bank and IMF says, okay, we realize the problem wasn't the loans or the structural adjustment policy, was the implementation. So your governments and your people are to be blamed. So what we are going to do to help you now? You take it over. So they portray like if this is some kind of independence now, you know, and they say you take it over now. So, you know, it's a catch-22. We have to understand globalization. I personally saw the destruction of my people in the Caribbean because of Dole and what's the other banana company? Dole and what's the other one? Chiquita. I personally saw it because I worked with these farmers. I saw them move from wooden structure to brick homes, to indoor plumbing, to having a pickup truck, educating their children. Dole and Chiquita strangled that trade agreement and told England and Europe, you cannot have protected markets for these banana farmers in the Caribbean. You have to take that away. And so they sold their bananas on the world market cheaper because they were exploiting laborers in Central and South America. And what happened? Our banana farmers in the Caribbean could no longer send their kids to school, could no longer support their households and their pickup trucks and so on. You know, I interviewed them and they told me, they said, I can no longer support my child in school when I could have a couple of years ago. So when you start thinking about causation, I mean, you gotta look at the political economy and then you gotta look at the human agency within country, because I'm not just saying that, you know, this is trade policies alone. Our governments have a role to play in it. And the class structure within our countries also have a role to play in it because they benefit from it, right? And so our low-income families cannot support it. But I like coming back to your thing about avoidance and denial and apologetic. It's interesting. I just saw the same arguments used for racism in this country. What's his name? I think is Winant came up with four different categories. One is your right-wing outright. One is neoliberal that tries to explain things without addressing race, and the other one denies it. So there are parallels.
Well, it's probably... One more question?
Yeah, just briefly, colonialism often went side by side with the spread of a religion, in this case Christianity, alongside educational systems and industrialization, which were meant to develop people, make them progressive and so on. So all that fell apart very badly, as we both know. So I'm wondering now, because you mentioned religion and well-being and stuff like that, what role is religion playing in the forming of communities so that we can actually critique it properly in this? Because it's all right talking and avoiding it, but probably a lot of these communities are also going to churches or prayer yeah. groups and stuff like that. Just wondered where religion fits in.
Well, you know, I said earlier that people ask me, you know, how do I feel when I go and do these studies and so on, and I said I get hope from the people.
Yeah.
And I have introduced human agency in every research project I engage in, and I advocate to my students, always include human agency. And that answers your question. As people, as human beings, they negotiate religion. And they take from it what makes them feel good. And the other things, they do some of the same things we're talking, either deny it or do not look at it. If you go to any church in the Caribbean, the pews would be filled with women. Over 50% of them are single female-headed households in Christian churches.
Yeah, so it's kind of...
Yeah, they negotiate. They negotiate and they take what they need to survive. Not saying that there are attempts. I mean, the history of Christianization in the Caribbean is another lecture, but they do damage in things.
Well, on that note, let's call it to a close. Thank you so much.